Good morning. Welcome to the adult Bible study. We're going to get started now. There's handouts. I've been trying to print more of them, so hopefully if you want one, there's one there. And if you're interested, you know, there's a web address at the bottom. I record these and I put them on the sermon audio, including where you can actually download the handout. You know, if you ever want to go get one, or you want to get one that's actually in color and looks really cool. So it's there. We're on our continuing mission to go places Sunday school classes have never gone before, and we'll try to do that today. I want to talk about government from a biblical and not a political perspective. At one extreme, you would have complete liberty and just sort of everybody does what they want. And at the other extreme, you would have no liberty at all. You would have a totalitarian type system. In the middle, you would have something a little different, and I'm going to suggest what you would have is Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai will be in the middle, in terms of, you know, like if we say, how do you establish a government in the correct way? And I'm not talking about form, like do people get to vote? How do you establish it in a correct way? And I'm suggesting the Bible has us a good blueprint of that. So we'll walk through that. I have sundry quotes on the back of this handout, and I just want to pick up one of them. The one on the top, I hope you recognize. You've read it before. But the second quote, let me read this. Exodus, meaning the book of Exodus, is history's supreme precedent and pattern for revolutionary change, and therefore for hope and the very notion of possibility. After the Exodus, as Rabbi Sacks notes, the world has never been the same. The contagion of freedom has been released, but Exodus not only models freedom, it has also launched a successful and sustained critique of the abuse of power that continues to this day. Contrary to the dictators of history and the apostles of postmodernism, power is no longer self-evident and self-justifying. Might no longer means right. Author is Os Guinness. If you've never heard his name and you want to go down the rabbit hole of thinking in a very deep level, a very scholarly level, I guess, on culture, how cultures change, and how to evaluate it from a biblical perspective, this will be the guy to go read. This is probably his most recent book, but he's been writing for about 50 years. He was a young man in the 1940s when the Japanese came through a city in China and wiped out 100,000 people. I mean, I've been there, but he witnessed that as a young man. He has a perspective on tyranny. We have a generation that has no perspective on tyranny, and we're gonna talk about that a little bit because it has something to do with this matter of freedom. So we'll go through some principles, but I want us focused on Scripture. I'm going to try to read some stuff from Exodus. I want to give you four principles. I'm sure there's more, but four principles about freedom and how you would establish a government that both protects freedom, but is not totalitarianism, and it's also not everybody can do what they want. Because everybody can do what they want, if you have maybe maximal freedom, you won't have freedom at all. Because those that can take will take away from the others, and they won't have their freedom at all. Somewhere in the middle, we find Mount Sinai. So let me walk through this. And I will read one other quote just so you have some background for this. I would offer that if you read the Declaration of Independence, you will see biblical principle right up there in the front because they knew it. I'm not saying that every person who had any involvement in this enterprise that we call the American Revolution was a deep Christian. Some were not, okay? Many were. But they understood tyranny. They had a crash course in it. It led up to the American Revolution. In 1776, things did not look good. Any sane person would have bet we would lose. George Washington was a man of deep conviction. He believed in the cause. While he was a wealthy man, the idea that he was just some wealthy guy sending some poor people out to war is just a lie. He was often on the front lines. And he had an army that was just in complete disarray. They had enough gunpowder for every man to fire their weapon 9 times. Most of the men had never fired a weapon. They did not have enough weapons. They did not have food. Do you realize that much of his army was wearing just, you know, clothes that were just fit together from little bits of cloth? And, you know, a lot of the a substantial portion of his army had no shoes. So when you're reading about them battling and they're walking through the snow, they don't even have shoes. They can't possibly win. I mean, that's the reality. That's what everybody thought. And I'm just saying, given all of that, this was not easy. Congress was on the run. They had been in Philadelphia, but by the end of the 1776, or even near the end, I mean, the British had already taken Boston, then, you know, which was a loyalist city, and they plundered it. That was the king's protection. Those loyalists were fools. He protected them, and they plundered the city. Then they went to New York to do the same. But the Congress was in Philadelphia, and they were making their way that way to take that. So when they wrote this document, this wasn't easy. There was a high likelihood they would die for it. You listen to what they wrote. And this is so critical to understanding because these are principles in the book of Exodus. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What does that mean? You don't have to be a Christian to figure them out. It's a matter of natural law. They believed that there was no relativism. There were principles that were true no matter who believes them. No matter what time, no matter the prevailing opinion, it's self-evident. What? That all men are created equal. Where'd that come from? Because only one place. Genesis chapter 1. People made in the image of God. There's this great saying from the Mishnah, and I won't be able to quote it, but I can say it kind of. We print money, and we print every coin with the image of man on it. God prints a bunch of coins, in a sense, that all have his image, even though we look different. And it's just this idea, you know, that God has put his stamp on humanity. Created equal. Now, someone could say, you know, were we living by this? No. The principle's right. The Americans at that time, many of them, did not live by this. We had a scourge on this country, an original sin. It was there then, and it continued, and it took a long time to get past it. And that's unfortunate, because you had people that had the right principle, but this didn't apply to everybody. And that's a shame. But this enterprise in our government had the ability to be self-correcting. Not fast enough, but self-correcting. All men are created equal. Who are they endowed with these rights? They are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. The Constitution was not written to give you rights. It was written to hold back a government ready to take them. There's a big difference. And it matters. They were given unalienable rights, meaning you can't take them away. They're not going to list them all, but they say these include life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, the very things the British had stolen. That to secure the rights, governments are instituted among men. Now read that carefully. What's the purpose of government? To secure the rights, okay? Not to give them, but to protect them, to maintain them, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's what Romans 13 says. The purpose of human government that God ordains, I'm going to paraphrase here, and I say it in the notes in the front, is to maintain an environment that righteousness can flourish. Not all governments do that. Our government hasn't done that at all times. But that's its God-given purpose. And when it strays from its God-given purpose, God will deal with it. But understand, like, they got it. This stuff's right out of the Scripture. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from who? Consent of the governed. Right out of the book of Exodus. I'm going to read you the verses. That's how God says a government ought to be set up. We have a lot of governments around the world that aren't the consent of the people. Okay, North Korea is not the consent of the people. That's not what's happening there. The government in Tehran, that's not consent of the people. Okay, that's why there's so many people who have fled those countries when they can. We don't have it all together here. We got a lot of things need to be fixed. But we were founded on this idea of a government that was from the consent of the people. We're not the only country that can claim that. But frankly, it's been the exception, not the rule. Consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it's no longer fulfilling its God-given purpose, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government for what purpose? So you can be in charge of everybody? No. Laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness, to protect against those who would take away the rights. So and you could read the rest of it. This stuff straight from Scripture. And they knew something about this because they witnessed the tyranny of King George. And it seems like you get a couple of generations removed and people have a different view of it. Experience is a great teacher. Well, let's look at principle one. Freedom must be won. Can you think of the big conflicts in the book of Exodus? When I say freedom must be won, I mean that if it's given to you, it likely can be taken away very easily. But when it's won, you hold it with value and you protect it. So big conflicts. Moses and Pharaoh, okay? Big conflicts in the Bible. And what's happening? There's never been a government like what God will set up in the book of Exodus. There's only been might makes right. And Pharaoh was the mightiest of all. So God decided to go pick a fight with him and show he could establish a very different kind of government, a very different kind of nation, a very different kind of people. And he does it in an almost humorous way. He picks this guy Moses, who while he was raised as an Egyptian, he's been exiled for murder, if you remember. He goes out to Midian, gets married, spends a long time there. His father-in-law is very wise. He immediately, or at some point, talks to Jesus in a burning bush, Exodus chapter 3. And Jesus basically sends Moses with a stick that turns into a snake to tell the most powerful man on the planet one thing: let my people go. Right? I'm here to tell you to give them freedom. The other fight is God and the Egyptian gods. 10 plagues. You'll never see it in Scripture, but it certainly seems within God's power to have simply made Pharaoh behave differently. That is, like if you've ever, watched, say, Star Wars, they had this idea of the Force, and Obi-Wan has got some stormtroopers trying to catch him and Luke, and he can just kind of tweak their minds so they think something else. He can, I wonder if God can do that. Except he doesn't. He lets Pharaoh do whatever he pleases until God says, no, here I'm going to draw a line in the sand, and you will not pass that line. Pharaoh will send his troops to catch the Jewish people as they're fleeing. He will slow the troops, split the Red Sea. He could have just turned Pharaoh back, just tweak his brain and make him go back. He doesn't. Then let Pharaoh come into the valley created in the Red Sea and destroy them. It's a battle between God and the gods with a little g of Egypt. 10 plagues. You had frogs, right? All kinds of other things. And then the 10th plague, of course, was taking their first son. Every one of those plagues, there's some god in Egypt in control of that. And God, with a big G, systematically tears it down and says, puny gods, to quote a recent movie. Puny gods. So you have that battle. Look in Exodus 5. This is Exodus 5. We're going to pick up a few verses from Exodus. We could pull a lot of them, but the whole story of Exodus is God establishing, not just liberating his people, that's different, but establishing their freedom. So Exodus 5 and verse 2. Of course, 5:1 says, Moses and his brother Aaron went in and said to Pharaoh, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go." Now, that's a pretty clear command. I don't think he had to ponder it. Well, what do you mean, let my people go? He knew. Why? So they can hold a festival for me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh responded, listen to this, "Who is the Lord?" You know what the word Lord is here? Like the Hebrew word, do you know? It's got, when it, because your Bible probably says Lord and it's like capital O-R-D, so it's for a reason. Who is this Yahweh? Who is this Yahweh that I should obey him by letting Israel go? Now you're fixing to find out, right? He says, "I don't know the Yahweh, and besides, I'm going to let him go anyway. Even if I knew this guy, I'm not letting these people go." And so you have this great conflict. Their freedom will have to be won. And what we'll see is after he gets them out, he doesn't take them right in the promised land, because if he did, they would be demolished there because they hadn't won their freedom. They had to be ready for what's to come. Chapter 7, verse 5 is another one, just, you know, 'cause while we're there. God says, "The Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the Israelites from among them." He'll stretch out his hand, that's the 10 plagues, as he does all the things that they don't get it, like turning the river into blood. I mean, where's the God of the river to protect it? Well, apparently he's a puny God. You know, God is taking this. There's a battle between freedom and tyranny. What does Pharaoh do after Moses makes his demands? Did he say, "Moses, you're right. Y'all ought to, you know, like it's like, you know, they don't have a labor union, right? Moses, you're right. I ought to give your people 2 weeks paid vacation, and they should have the Sabbath off, right? And they shouldn't have to work from sunrise to sunset. You know, we'll do an 8-hour work day. And we'll have maternity leave, and right? Is that how it worked?
Well, Pharaoh, in the eyes of the other Egyptians, he was also God.
Ah.
So he probably had the mindset that, I am the head here.
It's a good point. And I actually have a question about that later, about what's the difference between the kings that God will establish in Israel and the other kings. And the big one is Pharaoh is a god with a little g, right? But he really is the most powerful in the world at that time, and he just gets his way. Life has no value. If he wants to take it, he takes it. If he wants the slaves to work harder, if he wants to not provide them the materials they need to make the bricks but still require them to do it and all that, he can, and he does. I mean, he just...
But
for centuries, people were required to recognize the leader as a god. That's what was getting the Christians killed in the first century and in the second century, is because it was okay to worship Jesus, but you had to say Caesar was God, right? I don't know to what extent they believed it, but this man had a standing army, and he could just kill you. I think that had a lot to do with it, too. In other words, this is not a we the people. This is, and you study Egyptian history, it's dynasties, and they're held by power. And we did a session on ethics. These kinds of people rule by a utilitarian ethic. They tell you what's good for the country, what's good, and the person loses their rights in that picture, I think. So a great battle between freedom and tyranny, the tyranny of Pharaoh, and it's just an overwhelming tyranny, and it gets worse as Moses gives his, you know, says, let my people go. But that's the battle. That's, you know, God sets this up in Exodus, and you've got this, you know, a tyranny under Pharaoh, which becomes a picture for us in the New Testament of how we are under the tyranny or the dominion of sin. Okay? And that, you know, so there's a spiritual picture, but just focusing on the physical picture. To become free, to have some control over your own life. This is a whole generation of people that never knew that. Never. I mean, so freedom is, this is a big deal. I have a note here, liberation and freedom, not the same. I want to read something from Exodus 13, verse 17 and 18. You know, liberation is having the door of the cell open. Freedom is something different. It allows you to go and enjoy this liberation largely in the way you want to do it. But Exodus 13, 17 to 18. I'm going to start reading in 14, though. In the future, when your son asks you, "What does this mean?" say to him, "By the strength of his hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt, out of the place of slavery." We're going to come back to this principle. Freedom has a shelf life when you don't properly hand it to the next generation and instruct them in the value of freedom and what it took to obtain it. When Pharaoh verse 15, when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed every firstborn male in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of the humans and the firstborn of the livestock. That's the 10th plague. That is why I sacrifice to the Lord all the firstborn of the womb that are males, but I redeem all the firstborn that are sons. So let it be a sign to you on your hand, a symbol on your forehead. The Lord brought us out of Egypt. So, you know, there's this remembrance. And then here, verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them along to the road to the land of the Philistines, even though it was nearby. I mean, it's good to look at a Bible map. When you read Exodus, it takes a long time to get from Egypt to the Promised Land. I have to read Exodus, you know, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and then Joshua. And it takes some doing sometimes to get through Leviticus, right? Because that's the most important part of the Torah, but it's the part we bog down in. And then you get to Joshua, and it's a whole new generation of people. The book of Deuteronomy, it's a new generation of people. They're in the wilderness for decades. But there was a reason that God took them the long way around. He didn't lead them by the road to the land of the Philistines. In other words, we could have been there, okay, in a week or two or whatever, in a short period of time. Though it was nearby, for God said, the people will change their minds and return to Egypt if they face war. Think about that. They will give up their freedom to buy peace. That's human nature. It's never changed. That's how we do it now. You tell people that they're buying some kind of peace and safety, and you extort a price for it. And people will give it up. He doesn't say they'll be driven back by Pharaoh. He just says they'll give it up. So he led the people around toward the Red Sea along the road of the wilderness. When you read wilderness, don't think wilderness out here. Think desert, a place with very little water and food. And the Israelites left the land of Egypt in battle formation to take their freedom, because Pharaoh wasn't just giving it away. So anyway, just to say this, this is the first principle. It's got to be won, and therefore it's got to be held and valued. Principle two, it's got to be ordered and cultivated. And think about this question. What's the difference between a relationship of trust and a relationship of suspicion? It's a pretty big difference. There's a lot of people I know that the total relationship is suspicion.
Trust requires faith. If you break that trust, it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Versus suspicion or pessimism doesn't require it.
It's great. Trust is like a faith. That is, if it's a trust between two people, there is some giving of faith between one another, some confidence that you know, we know what we're going to do, and we know our bounds and so forth. And suspicion is suspicion comes from fear, it brings fear. And in many cultures, there it's, you know, the society, the government is built on fear. There might be spies. I mean, in the first century in Israel, when you're reading your Gospels, why do they hate the tax collectors? They're traitors, right? I mean, you know, but there's this, so there's this suspicion that can be there, and it doesn't work well. It doesn't work in a marriage. It doesn't work in human government. And it's worth to think about that when you see what's going to happen here. Humanistic societies build, I think, on suspicion. When you build a government it's in no sense like what we're going to see in Mount Sinai. It is designed to maintain control, not to protect God-given rights. It is designed to put power in the hands of a few people or one, not to be governed by we the people. When you do that, it's going to be a government built on suspicion. And you're hoping you don't get outed as the one who maybe is a dissenter, because it will tolerate no rivals and it will kill the dissenters. And we've seen that in the exercise of Marxism. We talked about that a week ago. How does it work in the book of Exodus, though? I want to read something from Deuteronomy, and this is a long passage. I'm just going to pick up a few words. But Deuteronomy 28, if you've not really spent some time dwelling here in Deuteronomy 28, in addition to a couple of other passages, like the covenant in Genesis 12 and restated a couple of times, like Genesis 15, When you read the Old Testament and you read the prophets, this is the context right here, Deuteronomy 28. This is the context for what you're reading. Because this is where God is setting out what he will do. This government he's establishing, he will write the laws, some of which are written right here in Deuteronomy 28. And we'll see in a moment, we'll look at it. God did not cram this down on anybody. The people got a chance to say, we agree to this. This is what we want. We could call that a vote if we want. They all voted the same way. But we'll get there. They know, like it's written, like in black and white, they know what the rules are and the limits. Deuteronomy 28, God says, now if you faithfully obey the Lord your God and are careful to follow all his commands I'm giving you today, the Lord your God will put you far above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come to you and overtake you because you've obeyed the Lord your God. And then he says, I'm going to bless, I'm paraphrasing now, I'll bless you in the city, I'll bless you out in the farms and ranches. Your children will be blessed, your land's going to produce great crops, which means you'll have food. Your livestock is going to produce more livestock. Your basket and your kneading bowl, so your source of bread, which is just symbolic of all the food you need, will be blessed. You'll be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. So where's the downside? Well, if you'll honor what God wants, there is no downside. But he's telling you, like you understand the what's going on, and this is what you're agreeing to. But there is a downside if you choose to be disobedient. He goes through more blessings. He talks about how God will deal with their enemies. But then there's a but. Oh my goodness, verse 15. God knows who he's talking to. But if you do not obey, there is a downside, it seems. But you realize that's how governments are always established. There's laws. There's laws in theory to protect, and there's laws to restrict. If you don't obey, then this or that will happen, depending on the offense. If you don't obey the Lord your God by carefully following all his commands and statutes, see how they're referred to? Like, this really is a law to govern a nation. He says, all these curses, okay, bad consequences, will come and overtake you. You'll be cursed in the city and cursed in your farms and ranches. Your basket and kneading bowl will be cursed, which means you ain't going to have enough food. The children, the land's produce, the animals' produce, I'm paraphrasing. All those blessings get flipped around. And my point is, these people have to have an ordered liberty. And God is giving them an order, a structure to their liberty in the form of the laws or the commands or the statutes that are throughout the Torah and especially in Deuteronomy and Leviticus. And he gives them these commands to what they'll do. And so it's not the tyranny of the Egyptians, and it's not the every man can do what's right in his own eyes, which is the tyranny during the time of the judges. It's in the middle, and he establishes something with a lot of freedom, but also there are limitations. There are things you cannot do. Can you think of one of the main things you cannot do as a Jewish person under the law? Moses went up on the mountain and God said, I'm paraphrasing, it's my Texas version, there's 10 really important things that kind of summarize most of the rest of this. So I'm going to put them in stone because, people are, they lose things. So I'm going to write it in stone. And Moses brings it down. Don't murder people. Can't do that. Well, all of a sudden, we don't get to do whatever we want, whatever's right in our own eyes. Now it's becoming ordered liberty. It's not that way in Egypt. There are people in Egypt who can kill whoever they want and get away with it. This has no exceptions. You're not allowed to murder. Don't bear false witness. Don't steal. You start getting these things. And then he gets more specific and says, if this or that happens, here's how you would compensate somebody. Now we've got ordered liberty. And ordered liberty, I'm suggesting, is the only thing that will work. It has to be ordered and it has to be cultivated. I want to read from Exodus 19. I mentioned this earlier. This is a we the people government. I mean, they were always free to go back to Egypt. That's the choice God gave them. So Exodus 19, verse 8. And Verse 7 says, after Moses came back, he summoned the elders of the people, set them before all these words that the Lord had commanded him. So he's basically presented the law to the people. Then, listen to this, then all the people responded together, we will do all that the Lord has spoken. So Moses brought the people's words back to the Lord. God sends, Moses is that mediator. God sends him down the mountain and he presents the law to the people. And he says, here's what it is. This is what God's going to require of you. This is how God, he's giving you liberty, but it will be structured and ordered. They said, we'll do it. We'll do all of it. Okay? This is you know, the one time in all the Bible when you have a picture of God setting up in great detail a government. And I'm suggesting this is the only way to work. There has to be ordered liberty. And this is truly unique. This isn't, there were laws in other governments, but not like this. The one other verse here, up in chapter 24, you have a more extended version of this, where the people agree to everything that Moses has said. So 24, it's verses like 3 and 7, but verse 3, Moses came and told all the people, all the commands of the Lord and all the ordinances. Then all the people responded with a single voice, we will do everything that the Lord has commanded. Then Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early the next morning. He set up an altar and 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel at the base of the mountain. Then he sent out young Israelite men. They offered burnt offerings and sacrificed bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half the blood, put it in basins, and set the other half of the blood splattered on the altar. He then took the covenant scroll and read it aloud to the people. This is the scroll that's got these laws written on it. And they responded, we will do and obey all that the Lord has commanded. They have a say in this government being established. They are doing something else, though. They're covenanting with God. And I'm suggesting that sense of being covenanted is critical, or it won't work. Like in other words, what really keeps people from breaking the law? We have laws. What really keeps people from breaking them? Is it just because I'm worried, well, if I break it, I could get caught and there would be a consequence? Or is there something more that's critical to why I would choose to be a law keeper, I hope, and not a law breaker? Yeah. Like the golden rule, like do unto others, you would want to be treated. In other words, there's a sense, a belief, and this isn't limited to people who are Christians, and there's some Christians who apparently don't have this belief, but there's a sense that I have a part to play in this society, and it shouldn't be just because there's police who could come out and take me my liberty that I obey the rules. It's more like, I'm trying to contribute to and hopefully see what we've set up in this country flourish. That is this idea that we could have an ordered liberty that allows us hopefully to pursue life and happiness and not be killing one another and taking one another's stuff. And it goes beyond there just being rules. The government's there to ultimately have a backstop so that if you do these things, you can have consequences. But it ought to be more than that. On the front end, there's sort of a covenantal attitude that I'm going to be a part of this. This is why a lot of churches have covenants, you know, and because it's different than this one, but it's kind of coming together saying, I personally covenant to be a part of this body of believers with this purpose and that kind of thing. And now what we have is community. And we're a member of that community. And that's the idea. These people became a member of this community. It's not just that the laws are there and there's consequences. They're saying, I am placing myself under this structure so that this community can flourish. That makes some sense, I hope, a little bit. Principle 3, freedom must be celebrated and handed on. These guys, and you know, they have a lot of freedom. It's not absolute freedom. But a lot of the limitations they had were the way we're designed so righteousness could flourish. You can't kill people and steal their stuff and so forth. this generation came out of Egypt. They knew what it was to make bricks 7 days a week. What about the grandchildren who don't know what it's like to make bricks 7 days a week? The American Revolution is hard fought. As I said, in the first half of 1776, there's no way we're going to win this. We don't even have powder. We fundamentally don't have cannons. Our troops don't have clothes. Most of them don't have shoes. And 20% of them have deadly illnesses that are killing them off. It's bad. And how can we possibly win? But they do. And big events happen in toward the end of 1776 to turn it around. And it would still take much longer to actually secure the victory. But what about a generation or two later? You don't have to go very far in time, and you've got a group of people who have grown up and they've never known what it's like to live under King George's protection.
The generation Joshua witnessed as young children great feats that God did while he was bringing them to the desert. So one can only imagine what they thought about God as they grew up.
Right, so the generation of Joshua, which would, and Joshua would be a little older, but it would include this young group of people in Deuteronomy. Right? Deuteronomy is kind of a second telling. It's like a reboot because the first generation didn't want to go in and take freedom in the promised land. So God, he blessed them in a lot of ways. They couldn't go in. You have this new generation, but the new generation does get to see the victories in the promised land. Just go a little bit further in time, though. What about the book of Judges? They're getting their tails whipped repeatedly. Because you know what they did? All this structured liberty stuff. We're going to do what's right in our own eyes. And God says, that's fine. Remember how in Deuteronomy 28, I said that if you do what I've told you, I'm going to bless you in all these ways. But if you don't, I'm going to put my hands behind my back and say, you take on those Philistines. See how it works out. Take on the Midianites, and he did. But what happened between the two? Well, I'm just saying there's a generational problem that can happen where you then get to a group that they don't have that same experience. Okay, the experience of those who first heard the news of Pearl Harbor and heard FDR give a speech about what happened in Pearl Harbor, this day that will live in infamy, and all these things. They have frankly, a different education than a group now. In the 1950s, there was a show called Superman, started in 1952. You remember how the beginning went, that Superman would stand for truth, justice? But if you watch a new Superman movie, it doesn't say that. Because the American way is bad, right? And what's happened? We get removed from that. People forget. One thing I keep on my desk in my office at home is a ration card. You know what a ration card is? From the 1940s? There's a whole generation doesn't realize that you couldn't go buy tires. That we won the war not just because of a bunch of folks who joined the military for $21 a month, including women, but a bunch of women who started working the factories here. Freedom was won, and it took the whole country. And we knew what imperialism was. My grandfather got shot a bunch of times. He did not have warm, fuzzy feelings about Japan. That's just a fact. But he knew something about this. And you go a little bit further, and it got lost. And this is what I'm talking about. Look what God has planted something in his system to keep that from happening, because he knew that was a danger. You would have a new generation that didn't understand making bricks. They didn't understand being under a grip of a pharaoh who could just say, die, and you died. So how did Israel do this? Well, Deuteronomy 6 is worth reading just a little bit of. God planted in this law obligations designed to keep Israel as a nation until the end of time, basically. And it's why all the other nations have come and gone, and it offends people if I say the U.S. probably has a shelf life. Israel has no shelf life, and there's a reason. God wants it that way. But why has it worked? This is the command and statutes and ordinances the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, so that you may follow in them in the land you're about to enter and possess. Moses is retelling the story. They need to know how they got here and their obligations going forward. But he adds to it. Listen, verse 4, Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. What's that verse called? The Shema, okay? It's like that is their verse, okay? Because no other country could say that. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. That sounds like something Jesus would say. These words that I'm giving you today are to be in your heart. That sounds like the Sermon on the Mount. It does. Repeat them to your children. Talk about them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Bind them as a sign on your hand. This became the practice of putting a little box on your hand or your forehead. It wasn't what was intended, I think. But the idea is that the law should be here in your thinking and here in all your actions. That you should live it, that you should teach it, and that you should hand it to your children. It's not something to talk about on Shabbat. It is something to talk about to your children all the time. And that's what you do. So, just see that you teach it. What about all those feasts? The feast of under the law. How many are there?
Well, there's the Passover, the Feast of Tabernacles.
Yeah.
There's
seven.
Yeah.
There's seven. One of them starts when? A little later today? Rosh Hashanah starts today. Okay. What we would, in English, we call the Feast of Trumpets, but like that starts today. It's the religious New Year in a sense. But why are these feasts around?
There's reminders, or it's probably intended to be reminders to people of what God did for them.
Exactly, in a very real way. And there's probably, we could say, you know, there's lots of reasons, but I mean, they're a memorial, they're a reminder, they're a lesson. You're again reminding this young generation as they come up. It's why even a lot of people I know that are Jewish, and they're not really religious in any sense, but they know these feasts and they know some stories and stuff, and it's binding of people. And when they get dispossessed of their land and they're in places that are not good to be in at that time, like in Poland in the 30s, in Holland in the 30s, they're still bound as a culture by the teachings that have been passed down, the feast, and one other thing. You realize how many history books are in the Old Testament? Was it just that God's a lover of history? You need to know your story. It's a shame that we allowed... I hear stuff, people say, well, history is not that important. No, history is critical. We need to, you know, history is our report card. We need to teach about the F's, the C's, and the A's. We need to teach the whole thing about this country, the good and the bad, the things where we failed and the things where we did some good, and hand this history so people can understand, so a young generation can understand. God required that in Israel. The history is there for a number of reasons, and I know it's part of it is the chain of events that leads to Messiah coming on the scene in the first century. But the fact is, he wanted that history there for his people because a future generation needs to know where they came from and how they got their freedom and how it was all bound up in a covenant with God and how he could protect it going forward. Well, education matters and freedom has to be taught. The last thing is freedom has to address wrongs in the right way. I don't have time to really spend with that, but I will tell you on the back of this, I put, and it's just my opinion here, and I've borrowed this from Mr. Guinness, some key failings in the U.S. in protecting freedom. We have a liberalism that seeks unbounded freedom, but the only moral principle is that you impose no boundaries. That's a problem. It's not a political problem. It is a cultural problem. It is a way of dissolving and destroying a culture from the inside out. Humanity replaces God as the source of freedom and blessings. That's why I keep saying, and the Constitution, the government, does not give you freedoms. They may take them away, but they can't give them to you. They can maintain the God-given freedoms. We didn't impose proper civic education in schools. It is a weird thing. Like, we just don't have any sense of that. I mean, I learned a little bit of Western civilization in school, not much. Yeah, but it was more just studies of different cultures, which is valuable. But to get beyond just a few facts and dates and allow people to understand what this was about, this revolution, this experiment in this country of not having a monarchy that was a totalitarian government and having individual rights. And like this is, it's a profound thing. And all I'm saying is, God knew you have to hand it down. That's why Deuteronomy 6 is there. We left that off. Plus, the people in charge of bullet number one are the people in charge of the schools. Finally, neglect of history, book reading, generationalism, which kind of, we want the generations to be totally disconnected because one generation doesn't like the other or whatever. And a thirst for change at all costs. It just kind of seems like an intrinsic thing with us as Americans. We just need things to change. We don't want to be old-fashioned and be like it used to be. Yeah, when they understood freedom because they'd paid for it personally. Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to stop there. Hopefully I've stirred the pot.